Coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas, and recorded live, Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
Ladies and gentlemen, from the golden microphone of the EIB, it's El Rushbo, reminding you that unless I'm trapped in a drug-addled hillbilly heroin haze, I never listen to the promise of tomorrow. And now, liberal alert, here comes the Colonel.
Oh, yeah. Just what the show needs, isn't it? An introduction by Rush Limbaugh. Somebody brought him aboard. Okay, that's fine. Everybody's welcome. And you're welcome back to the second half of The Promise of Tomorrow here on the Science News Radio Network, exploring the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation. I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason. If you tuned in last week, you heard our conversation with Dr. Gerhard Glimek, professor of electrical and computer engineering and director of the Network for Computational Nanotechnology at Purdue University. He was telling us about the very remarkable NanoHub. NanoHub.org, as a matter of fact, the largest nanotechnology user facility on the web. Yep, free. You don't have to load any tools or anything. Online simulation tools like tutorials and seminars, complete classes. I mean, this was some pretty fascinating stuff. And we didn't have time to complete the conversation with him, and so we wanted to bring him back this week because we were just broaching the subject of what he's doing about copyrights. And, you know, I mean, for all that stuff, because, I mean, it's some pretty fascinating things. So here is his answer.
The normal user that might use it in a classroom, or the experimentalist that wants to use it, what they experience is sort of like an applet, right? Whatever you have on your iPad or iPhone or whatever electronic device, it's an app. In fact, one of the Apple VPs we talked to called us a nano app store. So they experience sort of an end-to-end usability scenario.
Okay.
And the authors of this tool have allowed us to host this app on NanoHub and to host it to users. So, but they retain all the IP to that tool, but the IP that is generated with that tool is owned by the user that generated it. So it's an app store, in a sense, and some of these applications, maybe about 10% or so, the authors declared it as an open source. That means next to the tool, the launch button, like fire up this app, there's also a download button where you can download the source code onto your computer, and if you're a geek and really want to compile it and look at the source code and maybe modify it or learn about it, then you can do so as well. So there's really two components to that. One is the access to the executable, to the thing that does the computing in an end-to-end fashion, and then the second one is access to the source that really generated the executable. So that's one aspect of copyright versus really software licensing.
Mm-hmm.
The second one is really the other components, like lectures, tutorials, and the seminars. And those, we request that authors have a license statement. When we, for example, we videotape them, or when they upload, they get the option to retain the copyright for themselves. So, mm-hmm. So they retain, just like if they host it on their own web page. But we also encourage them to consider this Creative Commons license. And Creative Commons is a license format where the original author retains all the commercial rights mm-hmm. to the content, but this license, this Creative Commons 3.0 or something like that, is share and share alike license. So if somebody says, this is beautiful teaching material, I want to use it in my class, so they can do it. If they say, I love it, but I want to have a slightly different introduction, I want to introduce it myself, they can use components of that publication, integrate it into their class, and they share it alike. So if they were to put it out again, they should need to put it in this Creative Commons license. And but that means they can't make money with it, but they can use it for educational purposes, etc.
Well, that sounds really good. Now I have another question. Well, nanotechnology, the development and everything like that, especially with new products, is quite competitive. And what you're describing to me is some sharing of information around the world. I mean, somebody in mainland China or in Taiwan or in Korea or in Iran or in South Africa or anywhere in Russia or Georgia or wherever can access equally along with anybody in the United States or in Canada or in South America. Is that correct?
It's partially correct. I mean, by the Department of State, we have to exclude certain countries that are on the export control list, and we do that. Those are the so-called D&E countries, which are listed on the Department of State website. So there's no access to NanoHub from those countries. But in general, it really is about the dissemination of knowledge and insights. And in a sense, it's pretty much all published material, but it has been published in different shapes or forms, and maybe not as accessible. So it's a great way to actually disseminate the knowledge and reach a new user group that you would not otherwise have reached. So it's not so much, I think, giving away of valuable information, but it's a formation of a community that shares information and interacts. And what we can actually show is that we track publications, journal publications, where people cite NanoHub, mm-hmm. and we can see actually social networks forming by these authors around the usage of NanoHub. So it's actually fostering collaborations rather than just a leakage of knowledge.
Okay, so you can block hostile countries then where we don't do any export. Tell us, you're going to be at the 11th International Conference on Nanotechnology in Portland, Oregon, the 15th to the 18th of August coming up. What are you going to be doing there?
Okay, so I give two presentations there. One mm-hmm. will be a tutorial on NanoHub where we teach the teachers typically, or we also have a lot of nanotechnology researchers and students there. Mm-hmm. And we're really still, I would say, in the mode of making people aware of what NanoHub does and how it does things. So right now, most of the people that find NanoHub find us through Google, or they find us through word through mouth. So we're still in the mode of really, in a sense, promoting the material and promoting the website and making people aware of it. So in that sense, at a tutorial, I show how a teacher might be able to use NanoHub, and I show how researchers have used NanoHub and how we measure success such that we can continue to receive further funding from NSF and other agencies to continue an effort like that.
So we can meet you at the 11th International Conference on Nanotechnology in August in Portland, Oregon, and we'll look forward to that. And then listeners that are interested in knowing more about that conference can go to our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz, and on the right-hand side of the screen there'll be a link to that that particular conference.
There's a couple of things I'd like to highlight. One is so we created NanoHub as an infrastructure to enable people to run modeling and simulation tools that they normally would not have access to. Mm-hmm. And so there, in that sense, there's nothing special about nano in that concept, right? Many people in research use computers to do modeling and simulations and to evaluate data, to visualize data. And typically they do that on a desktop or they do it on a supercomputer, but they don't really have a good way to share that kind of material and simulation environment. So 4 years ago, in 2007, we created this concept of Hub Zero, which is an empty hub. Mm-hmm. And we scraped out all the nano-independent infrastructure piece of NanoHub and created a new software stack. And that's an open source software stack called hubzero.org. And we began to host other hubs. And now there's about 30 other hubs up and running and humming away with their users. Most of them are hosted at Purdue, but for various organizations like cancer care engineering, pharmaceutical design, global engineering collaboration. There's all kinds of different hubs now using this technology. And in a sense, I think what we created with this is a new view or an alternate view of the future of computing, in a sense. What you enable people to do is access compute power and tools that from their own web browser without installing anything. So you can reach a broad audience, you can reach classrooms. I mean, imagine a teacher going to a classroom wanting to demo something. They don't even have the rights or privileges to install anything on that classroom computer.
Yeah.
And most people wouldn't even know how to install an advanced simulation engine either, and
sure.
They shouldn't.
Yeah.
So in that sense, we changed the face of scientific computing slowly, but it's really, in a sense, cloud computing or grid computing for the masses, and it really seems to work quite well. There's a lot of information available on the web, and people ask, well, what's the quality, and how do you measure whether you have impact? So within our modeling and simulation environment that we have, we keep statistics sort of on who uses the tools and when they come and which tools they run, and by their behavior we can actually figure out whether people show up as a sort of like a classroom, because there's maybe a horde of people coming on some Tuesday night because their homework is due on Wednesday. Mm-hmm. And they all suddenly run the same tool.
Yeah.
And then maybe the following Tuesday they come again and they might run a different tool. So their behavior correlates with each other, and by that correlation we can kind of figure out they must be in a class, and also we know their locality just by their IP address that they come in and from their registration information. So that way we can now quantitatively document that an online simulation facility that is really open to the world is really used in formal training, which in a sense I think is quite an achievement, because a few years ago people might have said you can't really do that, this is not available, how do you measure quantitatively what people do? So we have now a real proof that is happening, and so the tools alone have been used in some 150 classes in over 100 institutions in the last year, in 2010 alone. Just the tools, not even the seminars and the lectures. We're still working on algorithms to mine all the data in our logs as well. So I think that the punchline I want to make is this stuff is being used for formalized training and education, which a few years back would have been said this is almost impossible to do.
What a sensational tool this is for learning. You really put in place something that is extremely exciting, and I'm so glad that we've learned about it. Well, Dr. Gerhard Glimmick, Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering and Director Network for Computational Nanotechnology at Purdue University, you've been a fascinating guest. So glad that you told us about the nanohub.org, and we are going to now have a whole new horizon to work on. So thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me. It was great. Thank you.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
I am waiting for you.